Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
We have an active shooter. We have an active shooter inside the warehouse.
Welcome to Active Shooter, a podcast that covers the whys, the hows, and the aftermath of active shooter and mass casualty events.
They have an active shooter in the building. A second call says they are being attacked.
I've been shot.
169 San Diego, we got shots fired at 415 AS. Route 91 sounded like an automatic firearm.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter,
mass casualty incidents.
Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Active Shooter, a podcast that may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of this show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
According to the March 24, 2021 edition of the Denver Post, in the 9 mass shootings in Colorado since 1993, 52 people have been killed and 125 have been injured. Those 9 shootings are classified as mass shooting, which is defined as having 4 or more deaths, not including the gunman. In all, there have been approximately 19 shootings since 1864. Though several of those shootings mercifully resulted in no loss of human life. In many of these cases, the shooter took their own life, and the ensuing investigation showed a long history of mental health issues, most of which went undiagnosed and untreated. Though Colorado has a devastating history of shootings, gun reform may not be the only answer to curbing the violence. No. It would be incredibly prudent to direct copious amounts of resources towards improving our mental health systems in conjunction with gun reforms. We must make serious efforts to put an end to the near-weekly mass murder events. The shooting at the Planned Parenthood in Colorado Springs, Colorado, was perpetrated by a man with mental health problems. And this is yet one more event that perhaps could have been prevented. Though the shooting may not meet the mass shooting definition as described earlier, it resulted in the deaths of 3 innocent individuals and injured 8 others. One thing is evident from this case, as well as all others. It should become the goal of each human being to see, quote, not one more.
Active Shooter the Podcast is a High Five Holly production, and I'm your host, JT. If you've listened to our prior episodes, you know that the Active Shooter podcast team has taken the No Notoriety Pledge, and we will not be sharing the real name of the shooters that we cover. We will be giving the shooters a pseudonym and refer to them by that name throughout the episode. This will help in clearing up any confusion in the story, while remaining true to our pledge in not naming the shooter by their actual name. We will refer to today's shooter as
Ian. Friday, November 27th, 2015, was Black Friday, or the day after the American Thanksgiving holiday, where retailers provide deep discounts on merchandise, enticing Christmas shoppers to begin their hunt for the perfect gift early each year. The day was mostly cloudy, yet small pockets of sunshine would periodically burst through the clouds. A light snow fell for much of the day, though there wasn't much accumulation. At about 11 o'clock a.m., nothing was amiss at the Planned Parenthood located at 3480 Centennial Boulevard in Colorado Springs, which is a part of El Paso County, Colorado. Less than an hour later, all hell broke loose, and many lives were forever changed marked by a brutal violence that shook a community still reeling from a murderous shooting that occurred only a month earlier. 57-year-old Ian approached the Planned Parenthood building that morning, carrying four SKS semi-automatic rifles. In his 2014 Toyota Tacoma pickup truck were five handguns, a shotgun, two rifles, and over 500 rounds of ammunition. Inside the truck bed were several propane tanks. As soon as the 6-foot, 2-inch, 240-pound Ian arrived, he began shooting, directing the initial shots towards some people parked near his truck. The man with the wild eyes continued shooting, and staff inside the clinic heard shots and jumped into immediate action, moving into the waiting room and securing the exterior security door.
I think I had 10 seconds, 5 to 10 seconds to look at him, to try to remember who he was and why he was doing that or whatever. And then the shots came through the glass, and then I started bleeding. As I was looking at him, I saw blood.
Ian shot out the glass part of an employee entrance, gaining entry into the building.
I heard everyone in the lobby screaming, "Get down, get down." And then I saw like gunmen walking with a shotgun, just shooting randomly.
He exited the building almost as quickly as he entered and walked with purpose to his truck, where Ian retrieved several more items and turned back. A witness encountered Ian in the parking lot and described him as walking up to her quickly and coldly, stated, quote, "You shouldn't have come to Planned Parenthood today," before shooting her several times. Miraculously, she survived. Another witness, Kiare Stewart, was in the parking lot when he saw Ian. He turned to run inside the building to warn others when Ian shot and killed him in the front entryway.
The thing I recall was he was paying for the service. His card was declined. From there, he went outside. And within 25 seconds, I just heard gunshots.
Ian re-entered the building before exiting a second time. He again strode towards his truck, where he removed one of the propane tanks and placed it next to a nearby vehicle. He walked back into the clinic and was seen carrying several black bags into the bathroom. The first 911 call was placed at 11:38 a.m., and police responded almost immediately. Upon arrival, Jennifer Markovsky was found laying in the parking lot, deceased from apparent gunshot wounds. Police began to cautiously advance towards the building. Ian was watching their every move from inside the clinic. His position was most advantageous due to the tinting on the windows, which allowed one to see outside the building, but not inside. Ian aimed his weapon and started shooting through the window at police. The ambush worked, as Officer Garrett Swazi of the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs Campus Police was shot and killed in the shootout. Ian had dual purposes for shooting out the window. His expectation was not only to take out as many officers as possible, but to shoot one of the propane tanks, causing an explosion.
We're being a second caller now. They're advising in the parking lot. Somebody is shooting. Actually, we're getting several more calls now.
They're telling you that CSPD is working an active shooter. Again, CSPD has an active shooter. 3480 Centennial Boulevard at the Planned Parenthood.
Oh, they're just probably walking down.
Hey, street.
All units, one car has been shot.
Need a transport. Troy, need a transport.
At least one victim in the parking lot of a weak vision, one of the key
shooters,
one in the parking lot of Planned Parenthood, and possibly a couple of additional others.
He's got shot at. He's behind Planned Parenthood.
The shooter is in a barricade situation inside the Planned Parenthood, and the male is barricaded. Multiple victims on scene.
I've been shot.
Ian shot with purpose and was described as having a stone-cold face. Indeed, when he noticed a man outside, crawling through the parking lot trying to escape, he wasted no time in raising his weapon and shooting the man. There were 27 people inside the clinic, including healthcare workers, administrative staff, patients, and their companions. Several managed to barricade themselves in various offices, where they turned out the lights and silenced their cell phones, precisely as they were taught in every active shooter drill.
It took someone to tell me to get down, that there's a gunshot. Even within, I couldn't register because it felt so surreal. And at that point, when I had heard the gunshots, I was able to make out a picture of what was going on because I saw the gunman and I saw him shooting. And once I realized that this is really happening is when I flee the scene and went in the back rooms. So I ran down the hall. I tried to open one door, it was locked. I opened another door and there was two people there. One was a nurse and one was an actual patient. And from there, they had no idea what was going on. So I immediately pushed them in the door, shut the door, and I let them know that there was a gunman, armed. Once they realized the gunshots is when we grabbed the table and placed it against the door because we don't have a lock on the door.
Amar Laskawala was at the clinic with a friend and was able to hide inside a bathroom. However, once there, a bullet passed through the wall, striking him in the chest. Thankfully, Amar survived.
I've been shot. Stop!
Another man was injured as he stumbled to a nearby grocery store, shouting that he was shot at the Planned Parenthood clinic. Grocery store patrons described the man as literally having holes in his chest from bullets.
Active shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active shooter.
Active shooter of mass casualty incidents.
Active shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active shooter.
Active shooter of mass casualty incidents.
Meanwhile, some police officers were able to make it inside the clinic and began exchanging gunfire with Ian. A SWAT team crashed an armored vehicle into the lobby of the building, smashing through two sets of doors to gain complete entry. The SWAT team and other officers rescued some people who were trapped inside and hiding. After getting access inside the building, a 5-hour standoff ensued. Police attempted to contact Ian, but he refused to communicate or answer phones as they rang inside the clinic. Officers threw tear gas canisters and set off the sprinkler system in an effort to force Ian out, but nothing seemed to work. Ian was intent on staying and causing destruction, though police could hear him coughing and whisper praying, begging God to, quote, take him home. Because of the sprinkler system being set off, water began to flood the clinic, to which Ian simply cupped his hands and started drinking the water. Ian also drew a cross in blood on the wall. What finally drew the standoff to a close was when Ian took a random credit card he found inside the clinic and drew on each side. One side said shootout, and the other said give up. Ian flipped the card as if he were calling heads or tails, and the card landed with the words give up facing upwards. Ian called out saying, quote, I'm ready to give up, as police were trying to evacuate victims and survivors. Finally, Ian surrendered, was handcuffed, and arrested at 4:52 p.m. At the time of the arrest, the snow began flying and was coming down like a snow globe, all shaken up.
Okay, he's
going to
come out with his hands up.
We have our suspect right now. He's saying that he is alone and he's by himself.
Okay, good job.
Once Ian was taken into custody, police began searching for explosives inside the building and inside his truck. The ATF and FBI assisted in the investigation, along with units from the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs Police Department, Colorado Springs Police Department, and the El Paso County Sheriff's Department. Because there were increased protests at Planned Parenthood locations all over the country at the time, this particular clinic had installed a security room where bulletproof vests were stored. Shelter-in-place orders and lockdowns were issued to nearby stores, restaurants, and other businesses, while the Tactical Enforcement Unit officer began evacuating the remaining survivors from the building.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out of my sister if she's still alive or not. I don't know.
Dealing with this tragic situation today, we have to confirm that we have two civilian casualties on scene, and we have the death of one police officer.
Ian had been shot during his exchange with police and injured his right hand and lower abdomen. He wore a homemade ballistic vest that was created from silver coins and duct tape. After the arrest, Ian was held without bond at the El Paso County Jail. A search warrant was quickly obtained, and searches were executed on Ian's home and truck. A number of items were collected, such as biological swabs, rifles, a shotgun, photographs, maps, notes, a phone book page, various knives, two pistols, ammunition, a hatchet, firearm magazines, arrow tips, bear mace, and a Bible. Ian was charged by the state of Colorado with 179 counts of murder, attempted murder, and various other crimes that were linked to the shooting. Whether it led to the shooting or was a final breaking point isn't quite known, but there was an incident before the shooting involving Ian's girlfriend. She was at the Pikes Peak Regional Hospital in Woodland Park, Colorado, where she had been admitted for pancreatitis and an infection. Ian visited her each and every day while she was there, and during these visits, he developed the idea that her doctors were federal agents in disguise, and he therefore attempted to remove her from the hospital before she was ready for discharge. Ian tried telling the doctors that he could care for his girlfriend, though his requests were denied because the hospital staff felt Ian was incapable of changing the bandages she needed on a severely open wound. Ian disagreed and indicated he could change the bandage, though when doctors asked him to show them how, he refused. This caused Ian to insist that his girlfriend was being held hostage. He claimed that he'd seek revenge on them and the hospital that he deemed the most hateful place on earth. During Ian's interrogation, he told the police that he made the choice to attack Planned Parenthood because he was angry that the clinic was alleged to be performing abortions and selling baby parts. It was wholly untrue, yet Ian was convinced. He claimed that he drove to Colorado Springs from Woodland Park on November 27, 2015, making several stops along the way to request directions. He even stopped and asked a mail carrier for directions along the way. Ian also carried phone books with him, and there was a page removed from one such book. It was a page with information about Planned Parenthood, including the address. After consulting one of the maps in his truck, Ian drove to the Planned Parenthood of Colorado Springs. Despite having a map with an address, Ian even called the phone number listed just to verify the address. He admitted to police that he intended to shoot a propane tank in the hopes of causing an explosion, and confessed that, indeed, he shot at officers as they arrived on scene. Ian talked about his girlfriend, who was in the hospital at Pikes Peak Regional Hospital, and explained why she was there, saying he visited her daily and told his story about his concerns over her doctors and the issues with changing her bandages. Ian advised the police that his girlfriend had a laptop that belonged to him, and she immediately turned it over to police for a forensic examination. He admitted to police that he had previously gone to an abortion clinic in South Carolina and placed superglue into the locks of the doors. Ian randomly began to recite Bible passages during his interrogation, in between admitting he was a loner and telling stories about being met in heaven by aborted fetuses wanting to thank him for saving unborn babies. It was utterly bizarre, yet fraught with obvious signs of mental illness. Ian chillingly told the police that he was proud of his actions and felt good about what he'd done. He had no plans to claim insanity and took complete accountability for the disgusting and deplorable acts he committed. 44-year-old Officer Garrett Swasey was born in Melrose, Massachusetts on November 16, 1971, yet he was a longtime resident of Colorado Springs, Colorado. An accomplished ice skater, Garrett began skating at age 7 with the Stoneham Skating Club, and later moved to Colorado Springs in order to train at the Broadmoor Skating Club, where he lived at the Olympic Training Center. In 1992, Garrett was a junior national ice dance champion, along with his skating partner. Later, in 1995, he and his partner finished 13th in the United States Figure Skating Championships. On January 16, 1999, Garrett married his soulmate, Rachel, and the couple had two children, a son, Elijah, who was 11 at the time of the shooting, and a daughter, Faith, who was 6. In 2006, he became a pastor at the Hope Chapel of Colorado Springs. Garrett later became a police officer with the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs Police Department in 2009, though he maintained his role as a pastor at the same time. Besides being a man of faith, he loved playing guitar, which he did at church. Garrett leaves behind his beloved family, as well as his parents and a sister. His death was tragic. As most would run from the sounds of gunfire, this police officer ran towards it, making every effort to save as many lives as possible and minimize the damage. Garrett died, but he died a hero. K.R.A.M. Stewart was born on February 9, 1986, in Waco, Texas. The youngest of the shooting victims at only 29 years old, K.R.A. thoroughly enjoyed watching movies, playing video games, and sports. His other favorite pastime was eating. K.R.A. graduated from Las Vegas High School in 2004 and played football during his time there. The times he was most at peace were when he spent time with his family and friends. They were his greatest source of joy. K.R.A. was a proud U.S. Army veteran that served as a specialist in Iraq. In 2013, he was transferred to Colorado, and soon after, his little brother Leonte followed him. After all, the brothers were best friends, and Leonte didn't want to be far from his brother. K.R.A. was no less a hero on the day of the shooting, choosing to run towards the shooting, trying to warn others of the danger that approached. It was his leave no soldier behind way of thinking. He couldn't run for shelter or cover and leave innocent people behind, so he tried to help. K.R.A. was described as an incredible friend, who was an intent listener and a fantastic father to his 11 and 7-year-old daughters. After the shooting, a GoFundMe was established, raising money for his family and fiancée, who was expecting. The loss of K.R.A. will be felt by all those who loved him, including his family, friends, fellow soldiers, and the entire community. 35-year-old Jennifer Markovsky was born on December 22, 1979, in Honolulu, Hawaii. She was raised in Waianae, Hawaii, where she graduated from the local high school in 1997. Jennifer went on to attend the American Intercontinental University, briefly working in retail during her college years. On July 7, 2006, Jennifer married Paul Markovsky in Las Vegas. He was the love of her life, and together they had two children, a son Alan and daughter Mila. She frequently made playdates for her kids and loved to see them happy and having fun. Jennifer loved all children, not just her own, and was said to be the kind of woman who'd do anything for others. She was truly selfless. Her interests were vast, and Jennifer had hobbies that ranged from crafting and baking to any kind of outdoor activity. She was a stay-at-home mom and was at the Planned Parenthood with a friend on the day of the shooting. That was just Jennifer's way. If you needed her, she was there for you. Jennifer will be deeply missed by everyone whose life she touched. Friends and family will never forget her.
Active shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active shooter.
Active shooter of mass casualty incidents.
Active. active shooter, reports of an active shooter,
active shooter,
active shooter of mass casualty incidents.
Ian was born on April 16, 1958, in Charleston, South Carolina. Though he mainly grew up in Louisville, Ian maintained strong ties with his South Carolina roots, particularly because his father had graduated from Citadel, which is a military college in Charleston. His mother was a healthcare worker, and father was a Navy vet who served in World War II and worked for 40 years at the Liggett & Myers Tobacco Company. Ian's dad passed away in 2004, although the reason why is unclear. When he was 9 years old, Ian claimed to have been struck by lightning and saw a vision as a result. It may have been the truth, or possibly the early signs of mental health issues. Either way, it doesn't appear that this incident has been corroborated further. In later years, Ian worked as an independent art dealer, frequently making deals with various artists around Charleston. He dealt mainly in street scenes, plantation tableaus, photos of the Citadel campus, and magnolias. Ian would purchase the rights to the photos and paintings and mass copy them, about 1,000 prints of each, and then sell the prints for a profit. While he clearly had some business savvy, Ian's educational background was in public administration, and he earned a degree from a college in the Midwest. Ian did have a criminal past with about 9 separate criminal filings against him. 2 of those charges were personal intrusion, which is commonly referred to as a peeping Tom. Those charges were later dropped. There were also 2 charges of animal cruelty, however, Ian was acquitted on both. One of the complaints of animal cruelty came from Ian's neighbor, who claimed that Ian threatened his life and threatened to shoot the man's dog. In turn, Ian accused the neighbor of pushing over his motorcycle, but it doesn't seem that those accusations went anywhere. By all accounts, Ian preferred to live a solitary life off-grid and wanted to be left alone. He owned 2 homes. One was in Hartsell, Colorado, though it could barely be called a home. It was essentially a rundown trailer and a camper on a remote plot of land. The second home was a tin yellow shack in Black Mountain, North Carolina. The minuscule place had no electricity or running water, and a no trespassing sign that warned passersby to stay away. The shack was located about a mile up a twisting dirt road, and it was the scary-looking type of place you hoped never to break down near. Ian had left South Carolina for its northern counterpart because he falsely believed that the federal government was after him. One neighbor reported that he kept his distance from Ian. He always had a strange look in his eye, like he could snap at any given moment. People described him as a recluse, who, when he did appear, he looked furious and complained about everything and anything. Neighbors reported that his dogs were skinny, to the point of appearing malnourished. Yet another claimed that they rarely spoke, but when they did, Ian tried to offer odd advice that struck the neighbor as paranoid. For example, Ian told this neighbor that he should install a metal roof on his house so the government wasn't able to spy on him. During the time he lived in South Carolina, Ian was known to hide food in the woods. Perhaps in his manic state, he was planning an escape. One area of life that Ian certainly seemed to struggle was his love life. In December of 1979, he married his first wife, and in 1980, the couple welcomed their first child, a son. About 3.5 years later, they separated, but the divorce didn't become final until 1985, which was more than a year after he met his second wife. When he was 26 years old, Ian met his second wife at a shopping mall. Ian was attracted to the woman right away and claimed he was divorced, though he wasn't yet. The new couple immediately started talking about marriage, however, she received quite the shock when she went to meet Ian's family and discovered that he indeed was not divorced and had a 4-year-old son. The woman married him anyway, about 3 months after his divorce was finalized. The second wife's father got Ian a job as a management trainee, and he moved to the suburbs, and for a time, Ian lived a pretty regular kind of life. The story gets complicated when in 1986, Ian and his first wife got pregnant when he was cheating on wife 2. By 1989, He lost his job because he had so many confrontations with co-workers. The home life was extremely unpredictable, and domestic violence with wife too was escalating. If she ever came home late from work, Ian would shove her and pull her hair. During one incident, she moved Ian's motorcycle helmet, and in a fit of rage, he slammed her head on the ground. His abuse wasn't limited to his wife, though. Ian used a taser on their yellow labs, just to see how they would react. The behavior was disturbing and terrifying. Shortly after Ian married the second wife, he started staying out late, or all night. In 1990, Ian's second wife became pregnant, and very shortly after that, it was discovered that Ian was cheating on her with a new woman. The new woman also got pregnant the same time, and Ian had two women in his life expecting his children. The second wife believed that Ian loved his new girlfriend more and accused him of having a gambling problem. She claimed that Ian racked up debt because of it, and he never helped her pay bills. He wanted to live like a bachelor, yet have a wife, a mistress, and have them all live under his roof and do as he said. Ian did enjoy gambling, and he frequently took trips to Atlantic City and Las Vegas, losing extreme amounts of money with each trip. As a result, he and his wife could barely make ends meet, living nearly paycheck to paycheck or worse. In 1991, they filed a joint tax return and reported earning only $15,500. In May of 1991, Ian was convicted of unlawfully carrying a loaded gun and a long blade knife. Whether it was this incident or something else is unknown, but wife number two had enough, and in 1992, the couple separated and finalized their divorce in 1994. Also in 1992, Ian was accused of raping a woman at knife point. It was alleged that he approached the woman at the Sears at a local mall and asked her on a date. The woman declined, yet somehow he managed to obtain her telephone number and started calling her several times a day, saying he wanted to see her. She continued to refuse his advances, so Ian stepped up the stalkerish behaviors by showing up at the woman's house on November 29th, 1992. He put a knife to her throat, and he sexually assaulted her. There was apparently a witness, though they haven't been identified. Unfortunately, the witness refused to testify. Ian admitted he slept with the woman, claiming the sexual encounter was consensual. He even took, and failed, a lie detector test. Sadly, because the woman who was assaulted was moving to Seattle with her husband, the DA's office declined to continue with the case. At some point in 1995, Ian met and married his third wife, and they lived together in a small trailer on Winding Creek Drive in Walterboro, South Carolina, with the son they had together and her son from a previous relationship. While they lived there, Ian liked to enjoy a cup of coffee outdoors on the deck, in his underwear. The neighbors erected a fence, partly because of this, and partly because Ian would frequently skinny dip in his backyard pool. He supported his family with his art dealing business. One of his sons reported that their family life was rather normal and quiet, saying his dad even liked playing video games with him. His dad rode his motorcycle along Sun, who drove a small dirt bike or ATV, and on Sundays, they read the Bible together. Eventually, Ian started to obsess over abortion clinics and anti-abortion politics. His abusive ways resurfaced, and in November of 2001, Ian and his third wife divorced after she alleged violence suffered at her husband's hands. He was arrested on several occasions for domestic violence in many relationships, and it was clearly the main reason, besides cheating, that he couldn't maintain a healthy relationship. In 2005, Ian started to post on dating websites. One in particular was called Sexy Ads, where Ian claimed that he was searching for, quote, a discreet relationship, casual sex, BDSM, a long-term relationship, and spanking. In addition to the dating sites, he frequented an online cannabis forum, where he wrote that he was seeking females to party with. In August of 2005, Ian shared a post that started, Savannah Sexy Woman Wanted. I love to party. Tall, Aries, male. In 2008, Ian met his girlfriend at the time of the shooting. They met online, and the woman was 13 years his junior. She had two school-aged daughters and was a devout Christian who inexplicably up and left her life to share a tiny shack in North Carolina with Ian. To be fair, the woman moved in with Ian after about a year of online dating. A relative of the girlfriend later reported that she confided in them that Ian wasn't sleeping well and was talking about the devil getting into his head. It was concerning, and he clearly was displaying many signs of needing treatment. Ian believed that the federal government had been following him home for over 20 years. When the state of Colorado legalized marijuana in 2012, Ian and his girlfriend packed up everything and moved there. The couple smoked marijuana and were forced to buy from dealers in their areas, which made Ian paranoid. Moving to Colorado would allow them to use and grow their own, legally. Ian purchased the land in Hartsel for $6,000 and placed a white trailer on the 5-acre plot. They essentially lived off-grid and rarely, if ever, interacted with neighbors. In order to make a phone call, they had to travel to town and use a payphone. Their land was surrounded by the Rocky Mountains, and a green four-wheeler sat in the front yard, and a black cross was painted on the front of the trailer. One neighbor recalls one of the few times they saw Ian. He was handing out anti-Obama pamphlets. Over the years, Ian called 911 to report various minor infractions. Once, in 2007, he rented out one of his homes, and then called 911 to claim that the tenant stole his pickup truck, a refrigerator, and a microwave. He always appeared fidgety and anxious with wide eyes that looked rather crazy. Ian was one to always seek revenge, and a former co-worker recalled a time when Ian would go running in work clothes before work, so he would smell terrible all day. Another incident involving a neighbor was when Ian poured gasoline all over the neighbor's lawn in order to kill grass. He was vindictive at best, and downright murderous at worst. On November 30th, 2015, Ian was charged with first-degree murder. He was formally charged with 179 felony counts. That included first-degree murder on December 9th, 2015. But on Wednesday, May 11th, 2016, about 6 months after the shooting, Ian was found not mentally competent to stand trial. The decision was passed by Judge Gilbert Martinez of Colorado's 4th Judicial District. As described in an earlier episode, for one to be considered not competent means that the defendant is unable to understand court proceedings and cannot assist their lawyer in their own defense. This determination is not the same as being found not guilty by reason of insanity, which means that mental illness prevents the offender from knowing or understanding right from wrong during the commission of the crime. On the other hand, being found not competent means that a psychiatric facility can work with or help treat the defendant with medication and therapy with the intent to bring the offender back to a place where they can grasp what is happening during court hearings and can assist their lawyer in defending themselves in court. In this case, the judge wrote that, quote, "The shooter's perceptions and understanding are not rational and are not grounded in reality." The evaluation continued, stating that Ian had, quote, "a mental disability or developmental disability." The competency restoration process can be very long and drawn out in many cases, though periodic court meetings are held to review the status of the defendant's capabilities. Ian was admitted into the Colorado Mental Health Institute at Pueblo for treatment. On December 9, 2019, Ian was indicted by a federal grand jury on 68 counts. The United States District Court Senior Judge Robert Blackburn determined that Ian continued to be incompetent to stand trial. Ian contested this decision by claiming, quote, "I'm opposing it. I'm not crazy." He continues to be housed in a mental health facility while efforts to restore competency are made.
Could you add to the babies that are supposed to be aborted that day? Could you add that to the list?
Counsel, do you have any testing that's going to be done before that hearing? Because that would be the purpose of the hearing, is my understanding, is to determine whether we had a right to have an expert present or not.
Do you know who this lawyer is? He's the lawyer for the Batman shooter that drugged them all up, and that's what they want to do to me.
I assume, is there going to be tests separately?
I'm housed with no toilet, no water. Contact Amnesty International. Have them contact me, please.
And certainly,
or the depth of Mr. Deere's mental illness until we receive full disclosure from the district attorney's office. Serious concerns about competency.
The truth coming
in this
out.
Case. And we are there a hearing within 30
they
days.
They want the truth out.
It's unreasonable, Judge.
This is unheard of that the prosecution is trying to help get the truth out, and you're trying to silence the truth. You're trying to make me go, you want to make...
I think the problem is obvious, Judge.
Nobody will ever know the amount of blood I saw inside that place.
And that hearing within 35 days.
Oh, I want the right. I want the truth to come out. There's a lot more to this than me to go silently into the grave. There's a lot of things that they don't want to be known. Planned Parenthood and my lawyer are in cahoots to shut me up.
Right,
they don't want the truth out.
Just listen to me for a moment, okay? For further proceeding state.
And I'm not going to agree to their mental health evaluations where they want to take me and put me under psychotropic drugs so that I can't talk like the Batman guy.
Finished?
On that, but I would ask the court to enter some kind of...
Let's let it all come out.
All right. The court,
truth!
The court can see for their purposes...
Seal the truth, huh?
But also...
kill the babies. That's what Planned Parenthood does.
Any objection to that procedure?
No, Judge, I do not.
We all have the unique ability to help prevent such a catastrophic event from happening. If we keep our eyes and ears open and never hesitate to report when something, or someone, just doesn't seem right. It's our sincerest wish that there will be no more active or mass shooting stories to tell. We pray that love will prevail over hate.
Too many have died! We should say to ourselves, not one more!
In the meantime, we urge our listeners to stay aware of your surroundings and keep in touch with your loved ones. If you see something, say something. You never know how many lives you'll be saving. Thank you for listening to today's episode of Active Shooter, the podcast. Remember, if you see something, say something. There's no telling how many lives you may be saving. A huge thank you to Darren Curtis, who composed some of the music used in this episode. Check him out at darrencurtismusic.com. DarrenCurtis, music.com.
Active shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active shooter.
Active shooter. Mass casualty incidents.
Make sure to check us out on social media. We have a discussion group on Facebook. Just search for Active Shooter, the podcast discussion group. You can also find us on Instagram at Active the Podcast and Twitter at Podcast Active. For just $1 a month, you can get access to ad-free episodes, early release episodes when available, and a shout out on the show. Just go to patreon.com/activethepodcast. Thank you, and be safe.